So what I want to do today is resist the temptation to talk about anarchism the entire time. And I sent around the terms for today, of which I only forgot one or two. So what I think I'll do at the beginning is I'm going to talk about very quickly about socialism and the difference between revolutionary socialism and reform socialism, add syndicalism to the mix. And these are all terms that I sent to you, so I'm not going to write them on the board because I need the board. And then for most of the lecture, I'm going to talk about anarchism. Because anarchists didn't want to reform the state. They didn't want to seize control of the state either by revolution or by electoral process. They wanted to destroy the state. And so I'm going to talk about those guys for a while. And most anarchists were not terrorists, but at the end I'm going to talk about a guy that I followed around for 4 or 5 years. Who was a terrorist, and arguably, it's a book I just finished, we can find the origins of modern terrorism in this guy, who's called Émile Henry. And this will fit into Paris, is obviously sort of a sub-theme in this course, and so is the state and capitalism. And this particular person, Émile Henry, set out to bomb and to kill. And his targets changed the name of the game for terrorists, and so that's obviously what I'm can't wait to talk about. But first, I'm going to just review briefly for you. It's getting briefer every second that I think about this. The socialist stuff, which you can read about, the rise with the rise of mass politics in Europe in the 1880s and 1890s, there was the rise of mass socialist parties. Now, basically, just to review, there are two kinds of socialism. There were the revolutionary socialists, who believed that, of which Marx was an obvious example, and his son-in-law, Paul Lafargue, a name you don't have to retain, who brought Marxist theory to France, who believed that revolution would come when the proletariat was class-conscious, after a bourgeois revolution, of which he basically thought 1848 had been a good example, following in 1789, and the proletariat would rise up and break their chains and bring this brave new world. And so there were revolutionary socialists in Italy, in Spain, and in France, and even a few in Germany. And then reform socialists said, look, states are becoming stronger and stronger and can break revolutions very easily. Look what happened to the Paris Commune of 1871 when about 25,000 people are massacred, men, women, and children, are gunned down, and that the way to bringing social reform and abolishing the abuses of capitalism is through reform. And this is the reformist tradition in Germany. It's identified with somebody who's in the book, Bernstein, Eduard Bernstein. And you can see this in the growth of the SPD, the German Socialist Party, Reformist Party, which was the largest party in the Reichstag in 1914 when war breaks out. And so what you do is if you organize, you can get legislatures, if you have enough socialists and enough well-meaning other people in the legislatures, in the Reichstag or in the Chambre des députés or the other parliaments and places that had parliaments, then you can vote in laws. You can vote in mine safety regulations because mines killed so many people. Mining accidents killed so many people. There's one in the Pas-de-Calais where hundreds and hundreds of people, it's 1,000 people get killed in one accident in about 1910 or 1911. You can pass an 8-hour day or a 10-hour day. You can pass laws making it harder and harder to employ children, particularly in dangerous tasks. You can do things for women. You can do things for families. If you elect the right kind of people, you can have a revolution through reform, through the ballot. And the great socialist leaders, such as Bernstein, whom I just mentioned, or the great Jean Jaurès, whose death on the 31st of July, 1914, was really the end of an era and the beginning of another era, a scary era of the war. And people had that sense He was the one who in France unified the socialists and the revolution, the reform socialists and the revolutionary socialists, though there are still fissures in their approaches. And of course, the old revolutionary socialists would become the communists after 1920, when the French Communist Party is begun in the wake of the Russian Revolution, which seemed to be even though it was a revolution in a very complex situation, that seemed to say that you can have a revolution. So reform socialists dominate in Germany. They dominate in France, they dominate in Belgium. The Socialist Party is terribly important. In Italy, they become more important, and in Spain as well. And so those are the two big traditions. Now, some of the tensions between revolutionary socialists and reform socialists can be seen in the fact that revolutionary socialists said, look, if you are working in the Reichstag and you're trying to get better insurance plans. Ironically, it was Bismarck's Germany that gives really the first substantial insurance program for workers. What you're doing is you're propping up the bourgeois state. You're buying into it. You're supporting indirectly their armies that crush workers in strikes, and they did in the heroic age of syndicalism. We'll more about that in a minute, 1895 to about 1907 in France, but in other countries it's about the same thing. So you're propping up the bourgeois state by participating in electoral politics. But lots of revolutionary socialists, and this is all in the book, so don't worry about this, but a lot of them sort of say, well, look, if we don't run candidates in elections, how are they going to know about us? So they too would run candidates in elections. So they're put at really kind of coincé, and they're really sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place, because they're running candidates in elections in which they do not believe. I'm not here talking about Russia, because that is more complicated with the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks and the socialist revolutionaries, and we will come back to them. So I'm talking basically about Western Europe. And you have to imagine that Lenin and the other Russian socialists are sort of walking around the lakes of Geneva and of Zurich and in exile and trying to imagine this future. But that's the big difference between a socialist reform and revolutionary socialists. Now, to make things even more complicated, you have a group called syndicalists. And the word syndicalist, it's an English word, syndicalist, which I sent along on a friendly email from yours truly. Syndicalist, the word comes from the French word for unions, which is a syndicat, a syndicalist. And what they said is, hang on, they kind of bleed with the revolutionary socialists. It's saying, if you get involved in electoral process, you are propping up this corrupt bourgeois state. You're propping up this dynamic duo of the state and capitalism. And they say, syndicalists say, look, we will organize from the ground up, beginning in the shop floor, the factory. And that will be not only a means to obtain a revolution, it will be a means, it's a way of seeing what the future world will be like, when everybody tutoies everybody or dues everybody, and the kind of relations, the friendly, equal relations of the shop floor become, after the revolution, become the way the world will be organized. And in the south of Europe, in Italy and in Spain, these folks are called, and I sent this around to you, anarcho-syndicalists. You see a transition here. Anarcho-syndicalists. And because they're rejecting the state and they're looking in the future, and the decentralized organization is part of it. And anarcho-syndicalists have considerable influence in Spain and Italy. They believe in direct action, in sabotage, in strikes, but in union organization. And one of the most interesting, I mentioned him in the book, but Fernand Pelloutier, who is sort of the theorist, P-E-L-L-O-U-T-I-E-R, Pelloutier, who wrote a book called The Dying Society, was one of the theoreticians of anarcho-syndicalism, of syndicalism. And he himself was dying. He was dying of TB, though he was not a worker. Tuberculosis was a working class disease. Go to Pennsylvania, go to West Virginia. You know, tuberculosis, the ravages of the mines in the United States were just incredible. And in, you know, porcelain factories and, you know, all sorts of places, glass factories all over the place. And Pelloutier creates these things called labor, or he's one of the people who come to these things called labor exchanges. And bourse de travail, you call them in French, but labor exchanges, which were towns where you had municipal socialists in power at the municipality level, the municipal level, and you did in some cities, are giving municipal funds to start these labor exchanges, which are buildings. You can still see them. When I was invited to Limoges to give a big talk about the by the Confédération Générale du Travail, I mean, the first we started the apéro, the first round of drinks about noon in the labor exchange, in the Maison du Peuple, the house of the people. And they were places where workers coming from other places could come and get a meal, get some money, and above all, find out about jobs. So for syndicalists, the way of imagining the future and preparing for this brave new world of post-revolutionary relationships, that has an important privileged place in the way they view the world. And there was an engineer called Georges Sorel, whose name I should have sent you around, S-O-R-E-L, S-O-R-E-L, and he comes to the notion of the general strike, that one day all workers will simply put down their tools and say, hell with you, capitalism, hell with you, the state, and they will bring capitalism to its knees. It doesn't really ever work out that way, does it? The capitalists and the state win the day. So having rushed through all of that, let me talk about what I want to talk about. And that is anarchism, of which there's only a couple short and I hope sprightly paragraphs in what you're reading. And I am not an anarchist. I was on sort of, sometimes when I give talks, at various places, such as St. Louis recently, and other places, people at the end will think, hopefully they'll never think I'm a terrorist, because I'm certainly not. And when I talk about this guy, I do not so with affection or admiration, but I know him because I followed him around. But I want to talk, and most anarchists were not terrorists, and one wants to make that clear. It's not surprising that the great strengths of anarchism are in Spain, in Catalonia, and in Andalusia, in the south of Spain, and in southern Italy. Why? Because that's where the Italian and the Spanish states have very limited success in convincing people that they're Spanish or Italian. And why should they believe they're Spanish or Italian? Well, the southern Italians thought that the Republic was a, or the monarchy, but the progressive monarchy, so-called, was a plot launched by tax collectors and industrial capitalists in the north of Italy. And in Andalusia and in Catalonia, where the Guardia Civila, who were intended to be from Galicia, a conservative part of Spain, where the odious Franco was from, or from Castile, the area around Madrid, huge area around Madrid, it was easy to see how they associated the state with something that they didn't want. But in writing about anarchism, I tried to put myself in to try to think of how anarchists viewed the world. And I want to tell you a story that's a true story. But if you're trying to imagine how anarchists viewed the world, this story is not a bad one. It's about a cork worker making corks for bottles of sherry in the south of Spain. And he's dying. And he'd been an anarchist his entire life. And he hated the state. And he hated capitalism. And he hated the church. And he's dying. He's on his deathbed. And he had married a woman from a religiously practicing Catholic family. And so in the scene, in this room, in which he's dying, in one part of the room is his family, who hated organized religion, who view it as a prop for capitalism and the state. And in the other side of the room are people who are not so sure. That went to church sometime, who knew the priest. And when he's lying there, the end is near, his wife's family says, Pedro, don't you want me to bring a lawyer in? A lawyer who will take your will, your last will. Anarchists don't have wills, and they don't have very much property. There's the other side of the room is just utter terror, horror. How can they suggest such a thing? That Pedro is going to make a will. That's a bourgeois thing to do, to make a will. And then somebody else from his wife's family says, Pedro, the end is near. Don't you want us to get a priest for the last rites? He'd never set foot in a church, and proudly so. Consternation on the other side of the room. How will it all end? How will Pedro end his life? With a lawyer and a priest? And so Pedro looks up and he says, go and get me a lawyer. Bring me a lawyer. And then he says, go and tell Father, the curé, the priest, to come to see me. Joy. Utter consternation. Pedro is lying in a bed in the middle. So pretty soon, the lawyer comes, dressed in his little suit. He doesn't yet have a calculator to tote up the bill, but he's got his legal pad. He's never been in that house before. And he comes down by the bed and he says, Pedro, you have a few possessions, a fork, a knife, a couple of plates. Don't you want to give me your will now? And Pedro says, wait a minute, senor. And then the priest comes, and he has his red, it's a purple, because I remember this from Jesuit high school days. He has his purple thing that they wear on Easter, and he has his little case also, which he has the holy oil to bless Pedro and give him the last rites. And he comes close, and he says, Pedro, the end is near. You've led a good life, but I haven't seen you in church very much, or ever for that matter, and your children are not baptized. Don't you want to make a confession? You're going to meet your maker soon. Don't you want to make a confession to me right now? They can't hear you. Don't you have something you want me to tell you, that you want to tell me? Isn't there something I can tell you? I mean, you can tell me, and I will tell you, whatever. And so, consternation on one side, silent joy in the other. And so Pedro says to the lawyer, he says, come here, senor. He says, I want you to stand on the left side of my bed. And he says to the priest, Father, come here, please. I want you to sit or stand on the right side of my bed. And then he smiles, a smile of utter contentment. And he says, now you can all see to both sides of the family that like Christ, I am dying between two thieves. And he died. And to imagine the kind of hate that anarchists had of soldiers and priests and of officials and of Castilian Guardia Civila, that was how anarchism was born. Now, when was anarchism born? There's a couple antecedents in the 18th century, but they're terribly irrelevant people that hardly anyone read, including a British one. It really starts with Proudhon, a name I sent around, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, P-R-O-U-D-H-O-N. And he was from the east of France, from around Besançon, or from Besançon in the east, in mountainous Franche-Comté. And he believed that if you didn't have the state, then people could live pretty much as with a little bit of prosperity, that they had a few chickens, a little piece of land. People tended to live like that there. It was a place where nobody had very much, but everybody had enough to get along. And he writes the following. This is my lecture note. To be governed is to be watched, inspected, spied upon, directed, law-driven, numbered, regulated, enrolled, indoctrinated, preached at, controlled, checked, estimated, valued, censored, commanded by creatures who have neither the right nor the wisdom nor the virtue to do so. To be governed at every operation, at every transaction, noted, registered, counted, taxed, stamped, measured, numbered, assessed, licensed, authorized, admonished, prevented, forbidden, reformed, corrected, punished. Under the pretext of public utility and the name of the general interest, that is to be placed under taxes, drilled, fleeced, exploited, monopolized, extorted from, squeezed, hoaxed, and robbed. And at the slightest resistance, at the first word of complaint, to be repressed, fired, vilified, harassed, hunted down, abused, clubbed, disarmed, bound, choked, imprisoned, judged, condemned, shot, deported, sacrificed, sold, betrayed, and to crown all, mocked, ridiculed, derided, outraged, dishonored. That is government. That is its justice. That is its morality. He wrote a book, a pamphlet in 1841 called What is Property? Question mark. And his answer is, property is theft. Now, he didn't mean that all property was theft. What he meant was too much property was theft, or unearned property was theft. And Proudhon had lots of influence among some peasants, but mostly artisans. In the world, by the way, the great painter Gustave Courbet painted a lot in the area around Besançon, Ornon, Burial of Ornon, lots of really marvelous paintings of people at work, the stone breakers, people just working their guts out for very little. And Proudhon, in 1848, it said he went down in Paris and put a brick on a barricade and threw up, nauseated by the thought of violence, of revolution. And his successors, so the leaders of the anarchist movements, were Michael Bakunin, whose name is in there, B-A-K-U-N-I-N, an enormously tall, bearded, heavy-drinking, heavy-eating, heavy-sweating Russian noble, a prince who was an anarchist who said, the revolution will come, it will come with a single spark, and all the hundreds of millions of toilers, the serfs, will rise up, and they will slay their social betters and create this new brave world based upon their village harmonies. And he said, destruction is a creative passion, quote-unquote. Entre guillemets, destruction is a creative passion. And in 1848, he led police on a merry chase. He spent time in the Russian slammer. He escapes through Japan, goes through the United States, ends up back in London, terrified people. His image, I mean, this is before photographs, or just photographs are just starting out, and there are photographs of him. And he met Marx, whom he hated, and Marx hated him. He thought that Marx was ruining class struggle, was ruining revolution by preaching over and over again about waiting for revolution. Class-conscious workers, what you need is peasants to rise up as they had in Pugachev's rebellion and all the other rebellions in the early 17th and 18th century. He dies in the early 1870s. You know, a phenomenal character. And the other Russian, a gentleman, a geographer, Peter Kropotkin, K-R-O-P-O-T-K-I-N, K-R-O-P, Kropotkin, yeah. Kropotkin is in the book. And he wrote a pamphlet that called The Anarchist Morality. When you get rid of the state, people are basically good. Anarchists believe that people are good. There's a tradition from Rousseau, by the way, there too. Rousseau, who lived in the east of France, or what would become France, around Chambéry, who believed in the primitive. Anarchists believe that primitive social relations and even primitive ways of producing things, just associations you enter in because you want to, were the future. And Kropotkin, who at the end of his life was once toasted by the King of England, and who had turned against the Russian Revolution, he dies in, I think, 1921 or 22. He was terrified by, disgusted by the Russian Revolution, which was already creating a centralized state. That's what he hated. He hated states. You must destroy the state. But he was a gentleman. Yet he and a guy called Paul Brousse, you don't have to remember, who became a socialist leader and then went nuts later, that's not a very clinical term, but he had big problems later. They create the term propaganda by the deed. What is a deed? A deed is a bomb, or a deed is an attack. It's the murder of an official. Now, the anarchists weren't the only one doing this stuff. There was a Russian group briefly mentioned called Narodna Vola, who believed in kind of a hierarchical system, post-revolutionary system, and what they wanted to do was set out and kill officials. But so did anarchist terrorists, and they killed officials, one of which you've heard of already, you've probably heard some of the others, President McKinley, 1901. Buffalo, New York, is killed by somebody who's received funds from an anarchist organization in New Jersey, I think, in Paterson, New Jersey, or is that Bresci? Anyway, Bresci kills King Umberto II of Italy, another anarchist assassination. They kill five or six leaders during this period of anarchist heyday, really the late 19th century. King Umberto II of Italy said that he considered assassination a professional risk. There were two attempts on his life, and the third one nails him. And Alexander II, who liberated the serfs, he is killed when he gets out of a sled to look at a bomb that doesn't work. And Elizabeth, the Empress of Austria-Hungary, who couldn't stand Franz Josef and lived apart from him, she is assassinated as well. But most anarchists were not killers. Now, if you think of American history, those of you who've had Glenda's course or David Blight's, other people here, you might know about Haymarket, the Haymarket affair in the 1880s. And there they hang four anarchists who are called Les Pendus in France. They had enormous influence. Les Pendus were the hanged. They're swinging in the breeze in a Chicago prison yard. They were anarchists, and they inspire someone like Emma Goldman, who was a Russian Jewish immigrant to the United States, who becomes an important American anarchist. But anarchists set off to kill policemen, or to kill heads of state, or to kill generals, propaganda by the deed, the spark that will ignite this revolution. But the man you see before you, and I've become today a very modern man, I want to tell you, because this is my first try at PowerPoint. The person that you see before is the guy I've been following around. And I got interested in him for two reasons. One is that he is the first, really, along with a bombing at an opera in Barcelona, at the Liceo in Barcelona, to target ordinary people. And to say that people of a social class were guilty because they were who they were. And that the spark does not necessarily have to be lit by killing a head of a state, as Sadi Carnot, who would get his in 1894 on the Rue de la République in Lyon, president of France. He takes the decision to kill ordinary people, and lots of terrorists since then have taken that decision. Al-Qaeda, a classic example. Insurgents in Punjab and in India in the 1920s, bombing officers' clubs. There's a terrifying scene in that fantastic but very difficult movie because of the torture scene. I can't even use it in the French history course, The Battle of Algiers, where you are with this woman who's planning a bomb in a cafe, and she sees the people who are going to die. She sees babies with their mothers. She sees people having a drink in the French community there, and she takes the decision to place the bomb. I believe that it kind of started with this guy. And this is, again, not somebody I admire. I know him. I follow him everywhere he's lived, I've been. And I guess if you're going to write a book about somebody as a prism on something, rather, it's good to pick somebody who only lived to be 21, because it's a shorter book. He was guillotined in May 1894. And again, I do not admire him, but I'm going to tell you about him anyway, with the help of PowerPoint. And so, how in the hell do I do this? I got to remember how to do this. All right. That's Émile Henry. His father was a communard who was condemned to death, somebody who'd fought in the commune. And so this guy is born in Spain. And his father contracted mercury poisoning in Spain, and comes back to France after the amnesty and dies. And he has an older brother and a younger brother. And what he does is, on a day in 1894, he sets out with a bomb. And he goes down to, he walks in the fancy boulevards that for him represent all of the class differences between wealthy and poor people. Center versus periphery and all of that. He goes down to the Café Terminus, which is on your right. It's those awnings there near the Gare Saint-Lazare, the Café Terminus. I've had the rather odd experience of twice, once with friends and once with my son, having eaten in the restaurant that my book subject blew up because it's still there and sitting at the same table. He goes to four or five cafes, but there are not enough innocent people in them. So he goes to the Terminus where there is a gypsy orchestra playing, pays for two beers. That seems a little odd, anarchists paying for beer, because the right to theft was something that they still believed in, many of them, not all. And most were not terrorists, remember that. He goes in to the cafe that looks something like that. Attends, what's happening here? Mass. Nailed. Oops, I'm not supposed to say things like that. Anyway, he goes in to the Café Terminus, and then he gets a cigar, he lights the fuse, he throws it up toward a chandelier, and it blows up, killing one and wounding about 18 people. that's not him, and this anarchist is called Malatesta, who doesn't look particularly scary there. But Émile Henry had gone back to Paris, or to the Paris region. His mother had a very pitiful auberge. This is the era of bomb attacks in the early 1890s. That's a marmite, that's as bombs are sometimes called. And he became an anarchist. His brother had already become an anarchist. And to put yourself into the early 1890s in Paris, ordinary people, but not so much as the elites, were terrified of anarchist bombers. Ravachol, a name I sent around, who was a poor, pathetic in many ways, but extremely poor guy who had been sent out to beg by his mother. They had almost no money. They're from a place called Saint-Chamond near Saint-Étienne. Ravachol was a counterfeiter and finally a murderer. He suffocates to death a hermit who had a mini fortune hidden in his bizarre cottage near Saint-Étienne. He escapes from the police and he goes to Paris. In 1891, police beat the hell out of three anarchists in a march, in a rather one-sided brawl, and two of them are condemned to big-time sentences. Ravachol decides to go and to kill the prosecuting attorney. And he places a bomb, not knowing where the apartment was, and the bomb blows up. Then he had set other bombs too. And then after having done this, he goes to a restaurant and he eats rather well. And he engages a waiter in conversation. And he tries to convince the waiter to be an anarchist. And the waiter sees he has a scar on his left hand, Ravachol did. And then he stupidly goes back later and eats in the same restaurant. And instead of bringing the second course, the waiter brings the police. And after a tremendous struggle, Ravachol is captured, put on trial for his life, and he memorably holds up, God damn it, how do you work this thing? Oops, I'm not supposed to talk like that. Anyway, he is guillotined, and he's really kind of a bastard. I mean, not more than that. He'd killed other people too, probably. But he finally is guillotined. But what happens is that two things happen. Not only in Paris, but in other places, is that the people of means living in the fancy quarters are extremely frightened, and there are all sorts of death threats that get sent around. But Ravachol, to those anarchist terrorists, he becomes a martyr. Look at him. Here his head is framed by the guillotine. Ravachol, who had been betrayed by an anarchist friend, dies at age 33. Christ died at age 33, betrayed by a friend. And so he becomes this sort of not, for radical anarchists, he becomes a vision of how life should be. And there are songs called La Ravachol, and there's another one called the Dynamite Polka being sung, because dynamite, from the point of view of anarchists, leveled the playing field. And they viewed dynamite rather as the way in which muskets had helped end the domain of feudalism. It levels the playing field. And dynamite, after all, was invented by who? By Nobel, as in the Nobel Prize. And so the people who support dynamite in French are called the dynamitards, the dynamiters. And the dynamite polka in Montmartre, where you have a lot of anarchist writers and artists. Pizarro is an anarchist, and the literary, the art critic, literary and art critic, above all art, Félix de Fénéon, who was a friend of Émile Henry, is an anarchist as well. So it's into this world that the young Émile Henry, here you go, here's just one of, I've read hundreds of these things, this said, you've always been hard with your domestics, you're going to be blown up. Death to the riches. There are hundreds of these things. They're all sent all over Paris, not just the fancy neighborhoods. And there, I've been in Oissy hundreds of times, but at the airport you hear these explosions sometimes as they blow up suitcases that haven't been claimed. That's the first known, machine that blows up suspect items, including lots of bad jokes, sardine cans with a little bit of powder left in them and that kind of thing. So it's in this world that Émile Henry learns to hate. And that he certainly does. That's where his mom had her auberge. Ironically, it's near Euro Disney now, but then it was a village. That's not the one. It was up the street a little bit. See, I did follow him around, you can see. And there's his mother there. And up on the right is the place he lived in, one of the places he lived always around, except for one occasion, around Montmartre. And that's his girlfriend. He had unrequited love. She had the disadvantage of being married to another anarchist. And he writes her clumsy poems. He falls in love with her. She blows him off. But in the end, she will take full credit before the press for having been the lover of Emile Henry after his deeds, his bombs, but he wasn't. And that's one of the places he worked in Paris. I love that because you hear that, that's a beautiful sign, and that company hasn't existed since World War I. But you can follow him around. And then in 1892, Emile Henry, 2 years earlier, he had killed before. There was a strike in the south in France, in Carmaux, glass workers in Carmaux. And so the third block on the left is number 11, and that's where the company is. And they found a bomb there placed about 11 in the morning, right there. That's not the way it looked then. I've gotten in there. I've gotten in there twice to see where he placed the bomb. My son gets a little tired. I said, Dad, do we have to look at another one of these places? They find the bomb, and they carry it down to the police station, which is still there. And it was a reversible bomb, which means that when the chemicals run together, boom, and it kills five people terribly, five policemen and a secretary among them, you know, body parts just all over the place. Emile Henry that's one of the places he lived. He is eliminated from the list of suspects because they said he could not have gone on the two errands his boss sent that day from near the station of the north, down toward the center of Paris, then up toward the Arc de Triomphe, gone back to Montmartre and gotten the bomb, placed the bomb and got back in 2 hours and 15 minutes. When he went on his trial for his life, when he went on trial for his life in 1894, a detective said, yeah, he could have done that in 2 hours and 15 minutes. So, being a bit of an empiricist, I did it. And I replaced tramway and omnibus with a bus and with a metro. I never take cabs, but I took instead of a carriage, of course not, didn't take that, I took a cab and I subtracted 11 minutes when my cab couldn't turn left on the Avenue de l'Opéra. He did it. There's no question about it. In fact, when they did the reconstitution of this building, he knew every single part of this building. He did it. There's no question about it. Why did he hate so? Well, part of it, again, this is the theme we've talked about before, was the social geography of Paris. Everywhere he lived, with one exception that you just saw, was in people's Paris. And all of the facades are still there. That's where he lived on the Rue Veron. It doesn't name. That's where he lived on the very top floor. That's where the poor lived. He gets the bomb there in 1892. And they hated Sacré-Cœur for reasons you already know, because it was a symbol of penance for the Franco-Prussian War, and penance for the Commune. And his father was one of the people condemned to death, who had been lucky enough to get out and not be executed. And there's a Zola novel that's very underappreciated called Paris, published in 1898. It's about a priest who, to take an R.E.M. song, is losing his religion. And his brother is an anarchist, Guillaume, and he has fantasies about blowing this place up. I think it's ugly as hell. But I once went with my wife to see where they cast the huge bell that would drive people nuts and still does, called the Savoyard. But that bell wasn't there. But as a symbol, you can't walk around Montmartre and not see it from various places. And so he becomes a terrorist because the people that he sees around him are very, very poor. And he convinces himself, even though he's an intellectual, he's a bourgeois, he could have gotten into the École Polytechnique, which is a super grande école. It's a big engineering school. He's a great student. He's an intellectual. And that's the other thing, besides picking innocent people, quote unquote innocent people. All people are innocent, but you know what I mean. The other thing is about he is not a sad sack or a dangerous one like Ravachol. He is not a guy called Vaillant who places a little teeny tack bomb and throws it in the Chamber of Deputies to call attention to the plight of the poor and is guillotined. The first person in the 19th century guillotined who did not kill somebody. And so this guy goes out to kill. There's a scene in an old Balzac novel called, all Balzac novels by definition are old, obviously, but called Old Goriot, Père Goriot, in which Rastignac, who is sort of this down-and-out noble who wants to make the big time in Paris by sleeping with all the right people, after Goriot dies, he's up in the northeast quadrant of Paris at Père Lachaise Cemetery, and he waves his hand down toward the fancy quarters, down, ironically, near where the Café Terminus would be. The fancy quarters, even before there are boulevards, and he says the equivalent of, it's war between you and me now, baby. It's a rough translation, but that's what he said. Emile Henry walking around on the hills and seeing people walk down to be domestics because they couldn't afford to take the tramway or the omnibus, horse-drawn carriages, he waves his hand and says, it's war between you and me, baby, and I will ignite the spark that kills you MFs right away. And that's what he does. And when he walked out of his apartment, he looked down, and happily he didn't have to see the Tour Montparnasse, which hadn't been built after huge payoffs in the early 1970s. Disgusting. But what he could see is these symbols of capitalism, the state, and the church. What did he see? He saw the Eiffel Tower, which was 5 years old, a symbol of the Republic and the bourgeois revolution as he saw it. He sees the Pantheon, where they buried all these Napoleonic marshals who basically got a lot of people killed if they didn't get themselves killed. And he sees Notre Dame. And he says, it's war between you and me. And this is the facade. I mean, I love this stuff. The inside building where he lived isn't there anymore. And now it's kind of an area that's a little bit sketchy. There's a lot of drug dealing. When I got myself into there, I had to kind of didn't want to look like a plainclothes policeman. Do I risk looking like a plainclothes policeman? No. I didn't want to look like a tourist, you know, sort of slumming. I don't look like that much either. And when I went by these guys who were sort of hanging out there, I said, salut les gars, or something like that, or hi guys, what's up? And I got myself in there to see where he once had lived. But the point of that is that you can see what he saw, and that gate is exactly the same as that day when he walked out to kill for the second time. And his bomb that he threw into the terminus, now this is back in 1894, this is where we started. It hit a chandelier and exploded. And he said at his trial that he threw it too low. He should have thrown it higher, it would have killed more people. Only one died, he'd already killed five before. And then people are terrified, they run all over the place. It was speculated that his was sort of an indirect suicide because his unrequited love, this lady who lived on the Boulevard Voltaire, whose name was Elisa. But no, because he tries to escape in order to kill again. And they chase him, they catch him, a barber helps catch him, a controller on the tramway hits him with the control mechanism that punches tickets, just like, you know, in the old days on those things, not that I ever was in a horse-drawn carriage, and they get him and they take him, he's arrested for murder, Emile Henry, and is put on trial. That's where he's writing his mother. We know a lot about him because they kept all these documents. So this is just, it was so fun doing this. I love stuff like that. You know, and his mother was devastated, as you can well imagine. She could not believe that her Emile could have done this. He was her pride and joy after the death of the father. And he's put in those of you who've been to Paris will recognize this is the Conciergerie. This is where Louis XVI, Danton, Robespierre, Marie Antoinette and others awaited. They put their head between the little window, as they used to say, la petite fenêtre, to be guillotined. It's also got one of the three most magnificent Gothic halls anywhere in France. And his guards took notes every single day about what he said and the anarchist songs because they want to prove that somebody else was involved in this. And there probably was somebody else in the 1892 attack who helped him close the bomb. Emile Henry goes on trial in April of 1894, and he makes a famous declaration in which he says, you have hung us in Chicago, Haymarket. You have garroted us, that's slowly strangling us in Barcelona. When Franco was croaking in 1975, they were garroting an anarchist, even at that time, 1975. In Barcelona. You've shot us in Germany. I don't know how they killed them in Italy, but you've killed us in Italy. And he says, you, the bourgeois who are in this cafe, you are not innocent. It's because of you, the petty bourgeois. You support les gros, the big ones, on every possible occasion. You forget about us when your factory owners throw us out when we can no longer work any longer, or women workers happy not to have had to prostitute themselves in order to pay their rent and their husband's rent by the end of the month. But what you can never do is destroy anarchism. Its roots are too deep. And he, on the 22nd of May, 1894, so I said about writing a book about somebody who doesn't live very long, He is executed at Place La Roquette in Paris, which was by intent the place where the state meted out justice, right in the heart of working class Paris. That was not an idle selection of a space. And we have his notes, you know, up to the very end of his life. This guy, Dibler, is the executioner. Monsieur de Paris, this is the executioner meting out, in quotes, justice. The last public execution, by the way, in France, maybe I said this already, was in 1934 or 36 at Versailles. The last execution was in 1974. And I'm constantly asked by people all sorts of political opinions in France where executions, public capital punishment is repudiated by most everybody, how that we still have it here. This is on a political diatribe, so I won't say anything about that anyway. But Dibler, his son, was the last public executioner, did the last public execution back when. There he is. There's somebody else putting their head through the little window. That's what I mean by that. We got to go back. Okay, and that's the equivalent of his mugshot. He was wrong about about anarchism, the roots of anarchism being too deep. What clearly happens is that there's a trial during that same summer where they put a lot of intellectuals on trial who did nothing except to say that they were anarchists or to criticize the state. And what my book is really a book also about state terrorism. It's about the overreaction of states. Our state is a good example of that. And the tendency to try to denigrate anyone who doesn't agree with us as being terrorists, whether they were or they're not. And the intellectuals, the jury sees through it in 1894. And only a couple thieves are condemned, and them not to death. Anarchism, you know, there's anarchists in 1968 in Paris. There are anarchists. There's a band of anarchists in about 1909, 1910, 1911 that hold up stores with most modern tools, shotguns, and things like that. But the anarchist attacks were over. There was no question about that. That doesn't make Émile Henry less interesting. As an intellectual, the cross-class kind of, and you see this in Middle Eastern terrorism too. But my book is also about state terrorism. What stops anarchism stops anarchist attacks in Spain is the fact that the public becomes aware that the police were hideously torturing people who did not agree with the politics of the state. They were torturing them. You can see where this one could go in a political a diatribe, which this isn't. In Italy, when the state overreacts, anarchist attacks virtually end. Now, anarchism does not end in Spain. It does not end also, for reasons that are perfectly clear already, in Buenos Aires. And there's still a huge anarchist community of exiles from these Western European countries, from all over the place, living in London. Ironically, in one of the more shishi parts of London, which was then very poor, around Charlotte Street, where you can't afford to have a pint of beer anymore. And that's where they lived. But so he was wrong about that. The roots of anarchism were too great. But the connection, you know, that I would make, obviously, and especially since it's being filmed, it's not the place to do it. But when states, including our own, overreact, what they tend to do is to and lash out in ways and imprison unjustly and torture and don't give legal rights. What they do is tend to increase the number of those people who despise us. And if you look back, and again, the commune is not a bad way of thinking about this, somebody figured out that of all the victims of anarchism or of terrorist attacks, no matter how you define them, the ratio between victims of overreaction by states to victims of anarchist terror, and I'm not apologizing for anarchist terror, I hate it. I'm not apologizing for terror of any kind, I hate it, but the ratio is 260 to 1. So I suppose there's a lesson to be learned there somewhere. But it was fun to follow Émile Henry around, even though I don't admire him, and to try to give you a sense of how people felt when they hated in the 1890s, and that their answer was not the same answer as socialists, which are to take power mostly through electoral processes, but to smash the state by blowing it up. See you on Monday.